Is the government of Eritrea an anti-democratic dictatorship? Does a recent UN-backed report make a legitimate case for referring Eritrean government officials to the International Criminal Court? Do national service programs extended indefinitely constitute a form of slavery? Is the Eritrean government justified in locking up individuals identified as journalists and turning away religious and other institutions? Is there a geopolitical and geostrategic context that justifies the actions of the Eritrean government? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we put the spotlight on Eritrea and speak with two observers with two opposing perspectives on whether or not the country is flouting the rule of law. We'll hear from government critic Andebrehan Wildi-Georges, who has served in government and is a veteran of Eritrean's War of Independence. And we'll also hear from independent Asmara-based journalist Thomas C. Mountain, who is a defender of the government. On this week's program, Africa's Cuba? What is behind international condemnation of Eritrea? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 25th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Angry white male workers constituted only a fraction of the Trump electorate. Trump received the vote of large sections of suburban middle-class professionals, managers, and local business people, joined by downwardly mobile Main Street shopkeepers, garage owners, and construction contractors. A majority of white women voted for Trump. City household residents still trying to recover from the Obama-Clinton-era mortgage foreclosures formed an important segment of the Trump majority, as did underpaid university and community college graduates despairing of ever finding long-term stable employment. In short, low-paid, exploited, and precarious business owners and service sector employees formed a larger section of the Trump majority than the stereotyped deplorable angry white racists embedded in the media and Clinton-Sanders propaganda. That comes from the article, Trump and the Collapse of Capitalism, Foibles, Fables, and Failures, the Financial Press and Its Keepers, by Professor James Petrus, posted November 23rd. In the neoliberal world where unbridled capitalism reigns, syndicates throughout the West report that the private sector in general, and especially the construction industry, a key economic indicator, is massively firing long-term workers and employees just to rehire them the next day as part-time workers with none or drastically reduced social benefits. Corporations increase their profit margins and transfer more public and social capital from the people, the workers, to an ever smaller elite. The pressure of massive unemployment, the result of Western-imposed austerity, Fed, IMF, World Bank, European Central Bank, ECB, deprives the workers of their dignity and power to resist. They have to fight for their and their families' sheer survival and are thus vulnerable for exploitation and abuse. It is Western colonization of their own people. That comes from the article, Unbridled Global Capitalism, People Wake Up, Time is Running Out, by Peter Koenig, posted November 23rd. The OSF, as well as the National Endowment for Democracy, is supportive of color revolutions around the world, including the toppling of Ukraine and the installation of a government integrated by two neo-Nazi parties, operations in Turkey, and the destabilization of Syria. The OSF also provides support to several American domestic fronts, including MoveOn.org, Black Lives Matter, Change.org, Occupy, and race agitations such as the Ferguson riots. Are these various groups now combined into one anti-Trump agitation apparatus? Project Veritas has exposed and proven the fact that Democratic Party operatives purposely incite violence as part of typical political dirty tricks. This new purple revolution phase merely ups the ante as more unhinged players join forces. That comes from the article. Post-election chaos, Trump presidency under siege, guided anarchy, and the purple revolution by Larry Chin, posted November 23rd. Readers on social media are warned not to go onto certain sites. The intent of this initiative is to smear honest reporting and truth in media. Our analysis confirms that the mainstream media are routinely involved in distorting the facts and turning realities upside down. They are the unspoken architects of quote-unquote fake news. One area of routine distortion is the use of fake videos and images by the mainstream media. That comes from the article, Who is Behind Fake News? Mainstream Media Use Fake Videos and Images, by Professor Michelle Chalcedovsky, posted November 24th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The African nation of Eritrea established its independence from Ethiopia in 1993 following a 30-year war and a UN-supervised referendum. The country is a one-party state governed by the People's Front for Democracy and Justice under the leadership of Isaias Afwerki. In June of 2016, a three-person UN-backed commission submitted a report alleging that representatives of the Eritrean government had committed human rights violations over the course of two decades, which amounted to crimes against humanity. The accusations include slavery, forced disappearances, torture, and indefinite imprisonment without trial. The authors had hoped to have the report submitted to the UN Security Council in order to have Eritrean officials referred to the International Criminal Court. However, the report has been criticized for allowing anonymous testimony and for lacking corroborating data or hard evidence. This week on the Global Research News Hour, we delve into the question of Eritrea's human rights record and examine whether there might be ulterior motives on the part of the major Western powers for wanting to embellish the human rights crimes of this African nation. We start with a conversation with a distinguished Eritrean national and author who had visited the University of Winnipeg in September of 2016 as part of a speaking tour. Ambassador Andebrahan Welde Georges is a veteran of the war for Eritrea's liberation and a founding member of the Central Committee of the Eritrean People's Liberation Front and the People's Front for Democracy and Justice. He has served as president of the University of Asmara, governor of the Bank of Eritrea, member of the Eritrean National Assembly. He is currently a senior mediation specialist and political dialogue facilitator at the European Center for Electoral Support. He is the author of the 2014 book Eritrea at a Crossroads, a narrative of triumph, betrayal, and hope by Strategic Book Publishing and Rights Company. Mr. Andebrahan Welde Georges speaks in this clip, recorded at the University of Winnipeg, about the extended national service program as amounting to slavery. He then explains his position in a conversation recorded at CKUW on September 26, 2016.
Particularly after the border war with Ethiopia, the national service, which was initially designed for 18 months, 6 months of military training and 12 months for national service in the different departments, in the different public work programs, road construction, building, hospitals, clinics, schools, etc. It turned out to be indefinite, endless. Once in, you're not out. People were 18, 19, 20 when they volunteered. In 1994, since 1994 now, how many years? They are in their late 30s, 40s, early 40s. What does it mean? They have been denied proper upbringing. They have been denied proper education. They have been denied the opportunity to develop their capacity and to earn a living. When people develop skills, when people develop expertise, not only do they provide for their own families and themselves, but they contribute to the development of the country.
The initial program is military service, but in reality, many conscripts also serve in the ministries, in public works, etc., etc. But much of that is done without proper study, without proper environmental assessment studies.
So people are maybe putting themselves in danger, or?
Not so much in danger. It's actually the deprivation of freedom of choice, the deprivation of the opportunity to learn and prepare for a future. Essentially, they are being robbed of their future, whether they are directly in active military service or in the civilian or quasi-civilian departments of the regime. The crux of the matter is that this is forcible, uncompensated, and indefinite.
There are other countries, like even in the United States, remember in the Vietnam War, most famously, where soldiers were actually conscripted to service in times of war. But you see this as being specifically different here, because that is what we're talking about, conscription. And I don't think I've ever heard conscription being equated with slavery.
Well, it's the particular circumstances that make it. As its inception, it was really, in my view, a legitimate program. Every country has a right to build a capacity for self-defense, not necessarily to commit aggression, but serve as deterrence to potential aggressors or against potential aggressors. And so when it was proclaimed in 1994, we had two situations. In the first place, the end of the War of National Liberation, which lasted for 30 years, as I said earlier, found us with a liberation army of about 100,000 men and women. And it was not sustainable for a small country like Eritrea, with an underdeveloped economy, to maintain such an army. More importantly, it was not necessary to maintain such an army. Of course, Eritrea finds itself in a strategic but highly volatile region, the Horn of Africa, the Red Sea Basin, and of course the adjacent Arabian Peninsula. And this has been, of course, in perennial crisis. And therefore, Eritrea needed to have a credible defense capability, and that was the purpose for the inception of national service. But it's also very clear that it had limits. The fact that it's indefinite. Otherwise, the idea was to demobilize this 100,000 Liberation Army, build a small, well-equipped, modern ground forces, the army, similarly an air force, similarly a navy, a very small, affordable force in each category of the armed forces for Eritrea. And the national service was meant to provide a reserve army or a people's army that could be mobilized in short notice whenever necessary, whenever there's a danger of aggression. That was the purpose. Now, when there is no active war, it is very difficult to justify it. And in fact, it's condemnable, because essentially what it does is not only forces these people to remain there indefinitely, but they're not compensated at all. That deprived them the opportunity to build and sustain families. And it also targets the family, because when everyone able-bodied because the economy of Eritrea is basically a rural economy based on agriculture and animal husbandry. 80% of the population, where the helping hands of every family member are very important. The national service, comprising the ages of 18 to 50, is the most productive part of any country's labor force. And when they are engaged in economically non-productive activities, the economy essentially suffers. And when it's a rural-based agrarian economy, the impact is that much more. So the cost is not only to the individuals, but to their families and to the country as a whole. So whereas a country can use conscription legitimately when the requirements of national defense make it necessary, in this case, in a situation of no war, no peace, then to maintain that is wrong.
I think that a point could possibly be made in the sense that Eritrea is located right next to this very, you know, aggressive military government in Ethiopia. There have been some border skirmishes there, as I understand it. And at the same time, you've got these larger powers, you know, the United States and China and Russia, that all have their own objectives, and these could impose potentially a lot of serious restrictions on a very tiny country. I mean, 6 million people. So I'm wondering if there isn't possibly a justification in the sense that you've got. Like Washington, for example, like they've seemed to be very closely allied with Ethiopia, whereas the Eritrean government is very openly trying to block U.S. Interests and hegemonic interests, or so the argument goes. I've heard Eritrea being kind of referred to or compared with Cuba in that sense, that you're dealing with economic sanctions and you're dealing, like I say, with Ethiopia right next door. So I'm wondering if that doesn't justify in some sense, some of the extended national service or other provisions that put them in perhaps in a state of a, extended, I call it a Cold War or...
You are right. The region is crisis-driven, volatile, and now you have fires all over around Eritrea. You have Yemen up in flames. You have Sudan with its perennial problems in Darfur, southern Kordofan, Blue Nile, the Nuba Mountains. You have South Sudan exploding civil war. You have Ethiopia, where you have these mass protests, uprisings. We don't know where they will end. You have Somalia, 25 years of really statelessness, essentially, stateless anarchy. You have tiny Djibouti. Then you have Eritrea. So this is a very volatile and crisis-ridden region. So it's quite legitimate for any country, particularly Eritrea, to have a program of national service that should be implemented within the frameworks or the parameters of the proclamation in a legal sense. National security is not predicated on the size of your army alone. You need logistics, you need to build your economy, you need to develop your society. Warfare today is not just manpower and arms. It's sophisticated. You need sophisticated intelligence gathering mechanism, radar system, air defense, modern artillery, tanks, all of that, okay? But it's not these weapons which fight. It's the men and women who operate these weapons who are convinced of the justice of their cause, in this case, national defense, and are willing to die for that. The impact of national service has been to deplete the country of its youth, with Eritrea providing the second largest refugee population to Europe and the Middle East after Syria, where obviously, of course, there is a crisis in Syria, the civil war everywhere, the rise of the Islamic State, etc., etc. So, yes, but this one-dimensional focus is not really serving the national interest or defending the country. Ethiopia continues to occupy sovereign Eritrean territory. So this huge army that is made up of national service recruits has not managed to defend the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Eritrea. Worse still, the Ethiopian army makes occasional forays beyond the areas it controls into other parts of Eritrea, and the response of the government has been very weak. And so national service is really a pretext to militarize the society, to regimentalize the youth, so that the spearhead of all protest and resistance to injustice, they can be neutralized. So national service is not really, in the Eritrean context, is not an instrument of national security, of national defense, but an instrument of regime security, an instrument of for prolonging the regime of a dictatorship that the Eritrean government has become.
I know that in the case of Libya and currently Syria, there is this sense that humanitarian concern and human rights is used as a pretext for larger hegemonic goals, be it Washington or other major powers, France, what have you. So I don't know. Is there a concern here that however legitimate the human rights crisis might be in Eritrea, that it will be folded into some kind of a military intervention somewhere down the line, as we saw with Libya, that could actually serve to devastate the country, regime change, but justified using humanitarian intervention as a pretext. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, the whole edifice of intervention in the Middle East, spearheaded by the Bush administration in the United States and the Blair administration in the United Kingdom, was based on fabricated facts. There were neither weapons of mass destruction nor any links of the regime with Al-Qaeda. And therefore, the whole justification for the war in Iraq was based on essentially lies, if I may say so, fabricated facts. And he hit the nail in the head when he say this hegemonic. And the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the dismantling of the Iraqi army is directly linked to the rise of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. So the root cause of all that is this external intervention. And then in Libya, the same. We in Eritrea are firmly opposed to any external intervention. In fact, if my personal view is that the legitimate form for the trial of alleged crimes committed in Eritrea would be Eritrea itself, not the ICC. As he implied, it's selective prosecution, ignoring people who've committed enormous crimes, whose acts have been the cause of millions of lives lost, displaced, are not even accused. They are not pursued. It's the little guys. And what essentially, even among the little guys, the ICC actually goes after the vanquished, not after the victor. And so selective justice to me is injustice. A capacity to treat similar situations similarly, I think, gives a sort of balance to any justice system. It's for this reason that the AU and the most African states are thinking of withdrawing from the ICC. So in terms of the Eritrean case, in the first place, it's not really a foregone conclusion that a resolution would pass in the United Nations Security Council. You know how the Security Council operates. It's essentially the P5, the permanent five members of the Security Council, which run the show. And anyone can block anything, depending on where is national interest. There's no principle, there's no justice in international relations. International relation is for the struggle for power, for domination, national domination. So each is seeking its national interest, often camouflaged in terms of justice, in terms of human rights, in terms of that. Look, human rights, what's happening in Yemen. Now, this mass bombardment of civilian targets, including hospitals, including civilian residence areas. And who's orchestrating that? Who is behind all that? So in Eritrea has always been, of course, neglected by the international community. For 30 years, the Eritrean people fought alone. And the United Nations, which in the first place imposed the federal arrangement with Ethiopia, had committed to remain seized of the matter in the event that the federal arrangement was violated. For 30 years, it raised no voice at all, even the AU. So in Eritrea, our experience convinced us that we must be in the driver's seat ourselves. Change is our business. Administration of justice against the aggrieved members of our society is our business. We may need maybe international support on our terms to strengthen our capacity to do what we want. Otherwise, would be opposed to any attempt to intervene in Eritrea or Eritrean affairs under any pretext, because our experience and the experience of the neighborhood that we were talking about, Syria, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, closer to home, all of that demonstrates that camouflage in terms of humanitarian protection, in terms of this, that, is always the national interest that the driving force of foreign military intervention.
Okay. Dr. Andy Brahan Wilde Georges, I want to thank you very much for sharing these thoughts with us and these very important perspectives. And I want to wish you all the best and you as you continue your journey across Canada.
Thank you very much for having me. And we hope we'll see each other again.
Dr. Andy Brahan Wilde Georges, he is currently the Senior Mediation Specialist and Political Dialogue Facilitator at the European Center for Electoral Support. And his book is Eritrea at a Crossroads, a Narrative of Triumph, Betrayal, and Hope. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We are joined right now by Thomas C. Mountain. He is an independent journalist. He's been living in Asmara, Eritrea, since 2006. And he joins us to shed a different perspective on the situation, the human rights situation, and the geopolitical situation facing the people of Eritrea. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour, Mr. Mountain.
Glad to be on.
You wrote an article recently basically calling Eritrea the Africa's Cuba. What exactly were you referring to there?
Eritrea, like Cuba, are the two countries that came to power through the armed struggle. Cuba is the only country in Latin America that the government came to power through the armed struggle in opposition to an election or a negotiation. And Eritrea is the only country in Africa that came to power by the armed struggle. So we have a basic similarities right there. And as a result, we've been targeted. Both countries have been targeted by the United States as being dictatorships, as being supporting terrorism, as being major violators of human rights, and all these nasty things, and all our neighbors are the real major violators, and we're actually a kind of like a very peaceful, calm, harmonious society. I'll give you an example. Eritrea is half Muslim and half Christian, and we don't have any religious problems here. And yet the United States government accuses Eritrea of oppressing a religion, that we don't have religious freedom here. I mean, you know, they say we support terrorism. They say Cuba, for many, many years, Cuba was actually a victim of Western American terrorism, but they accused Cuba of supporting terrorism. Just like the United States rammed through some sanctions in 2009 against Eritrea, alleging that Eritrea was supporting Al-Shabaab, the terrorist organization in Somalia. Well, we know from thanks to WikiLeaks that no, that was all a lie, that they're passing these sanctions to try to stop our mining industry from getting started.
There was a specific WikiLeaks disclosure about the purpose of the calling for the pointing to Eritrea, yes, giving arms to Al-Shabaab.
Yes, there was actually two very telling exposures. The first was in 2007, the end of 2007, when the Bush administration, where the Americans first were claiming that Eritrea was supporting terrorism, and there was the senior U.S. diplomat in the Horn of Africa, Ethiopian Ambassador Donald Yamamoto, said in a secret cable that Eritrea's involvement in Somalia was insignificant, as in very small or trivial. At the same time, they were saying we're supporting terrorism. And then in 2009, at the end of 2009, right as Eritrea was, mining industry was coming in and trying to secure financing for their first gold mine, they passed these sanctions and that blocked that, the German banks from financing us. And there was a specific leak in WikiLeaks. And I've written about this in my articles, but so it's all a lie. We never, Eritrea has been the victim of terrorism just like Cuba, and Eritrea has been against terrorism. And so, but they accuse us of being terrorists and put sanctions on us and do economic sabotage against us that way. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities between Eritrea and the Eritrean national motto is we never kneel down. So the Americans come into Africa and say, look, you got to kneel down, you got to play the game, you got to get loans from the IMF and the World Bank. Well, Eritrea won't take these predatory loans from the IMF and World Bank. But it enrages Americans because they can't control our economy. We're independent, just like Cuba. And both like Cuba, Eritrea is in a very strategic part of the world. We straddle the Bab al-Mandeb, which is a gateway between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. Now, since the economic crisis of 2008, there's been a major shift in international trade. The largest trading partners in the world are no longer North America and Asia. It's now Asia and Europe, number one trading partners. And almost all of this trade passes through the Red Sea. So on the northern side, you've got the Egyptian army receiving $1.5 billion a year from the U.S. to maintain the Suez Canal. But the problem is in the southern side, the Bab al-Mandeb, you've got Eritrea, you've got Somalia, you've got Yemen. Well, it's no coincidence that the Americans are involved in the war in Yemen, but the Americans are involved in the war in Somalia. And Americans have basically been hostile and through their surrogates in Ethiopia, attacking Eritrea for the last 15 years. Because the United States knows that the day the U.S. loses control of the Bab al-Mandeb marks the beginning of the end of U.S. Pax Americana's control internationally. The U.S. is not an economic power of the first rate anymore, but they are the world's premier military power. So the only leverage the U.S. has now is through military. And if the trade between Europe and Asia is no longer controlled by the U.S. military, then why should they all kneel down to the U.S. and say, God bless America? So this is why Eritrea is very critical.
I just wanted to kind of maybe, have you address a little bit more like what you call the human rights mob and the arguments that they're putting forward about the human rights situation.
Hey, you found that article, sure.
Sorry.
First of all, Nobody from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, or the Committee of Investigation, I call them the Committee of Instigation at the UN, instigate economic sabotage against us, have ever been to Eritrea. And they won't talk to me. They won't respond to my questions. They actually continue to deny that there's an independent journalist based in Eritrea. I've been here 10 years. Okay, I've been interviewed in all kinds of international news channels, and I've been contributing, I don't know, some 75 articles to Counterpunch and hundreds of other articles out internationally, and yet there's no independent journalist in Eritrea. But that's, you know, I mean, in any case, so, you know, there's just a series of fabrications, what they're saying. Now, I have no affiliation with the government. I'm not a member. My wife is an ex-fighter, Eritrean ex-fighter. That's why I get to live here, but she's not affiliated with the government. We have no business ties with the government. We're not employed by the government. So I have no reason, you know, to lie about what I'm seeing. And what I'm seeing is, life is hard. I mean, we're under sanctions. You know, the economy is bad because of the sanctions. And also because of global warming, we've had six droughts. And since 2003, there's been six droughts in the last 12 years. We've had two back-to-back droughts, never happened in history. We're an agricultural society. We're getting hammered by climate change. I call it climate disaster. Okay, so we've been facing hard times economically. Okay, so, but they say, oh, this is, we're North Korea. That's a joke. I've got complete access to the internet. I've got complete access to all kinds of satellite channels. I probably watch more international news here in Eritrea than you do in Canada. And I can go to all these Eritrean opposition websites. I go to Ethiopian websites. I have no restrictions on internet. So, I mean, all this talk about North Korea and all this business is just really a bunch of BS. It's just not like that here. They say it's a police state. You can hardly find a policeman on the streets. When you do, he's not even armed. I'm more afraid of the police in Western countries than I am here, because in the Western countries, they carry firearms, and here they don't. So how could we be a police state if our police aren't even armed? Hmm. They walk around, not even batons. It's just their traffic police. That's it. So, I mean, you know, we do have national service here, and it's a requirement. It's absolutely necessary, because in 2000, year 2000, Ethiopia invaded Eritrea. Almost 20,000 Eritrean soldiers died in the war. 1.5 million Eritreans became internally displaced persons. And ever since then, there's been a no-war, no-peace situation. Ethiopia has been violating the final and binding peace agreement that the UN, the U.S., and everybody promised to enforce and failed to do. And there are like half a million, up to a million Ethiopian troops on our 1,000-kilometer border. Okay, we've got a 600-mile border with Ethiopia. We've only got 5 million people in the country, if that, maybe 4 million. There's like almost 90 million Ethiopians. So to have us be able to defend a 1,000-kilometer border, we've got to mobilize all the youth. And the Ethiopians are continuously send up to division size, I'm talking 5,000 units across the border to attack in Eritrea. Just past June, we had another major attack here across the border from Ethiopia. So the government has to maintain a standing army on the border in some very nasty conditions. And this has been going on for 16 years. Just imagine if Canada had gotten a war with the U.S. and been invaded by the U.S. and some, 100,000 Canadian soldiers died in the war defending their country from the U.S. and something like 8, 9, 10 million Canadians were refugees internally in the country, and you still had to defend your border with the United States, with Canada's population. And you were forced to do that, right? And all you young people have been stuck in the trench for 16 years. Wouldn't the Canadian young people be fed up?
Mm.
And you couldn't blame them, right?
So
I mean, that's the situation we've been facing. So our young kids, we have a lot of problems. But
I just want to point out, like, for our listeners, that one of the big issues in the UN Commission of Inquiry report released earlier this year was the concern about the national service being extended indefinitely. And I don't know, are you saying the kinds of conditions that you were just mentioning is a defense of that? Because that actually has been compared to slavery. That's in the Commission of Inquiry.
Yeah, they say a lot of nasty things about a national service. But see, almost all the public school teachers here are national service. Almost all our medical staff, our technicians, our nurses, our young doctors are all national service. Everybody works in the government. We're a socialist country. So, but the problem is we have to have a huge standing army. It's, you know, we have to have like a couple of 100,000 of our young people on the border. Okay, we got 4 million people, 5 million people, and we have to have a couple 100,000 in trenches on the border. It's 40 degrees centigrade, and there's malaria out there. Our young people get fed up, and I understand. It's been going on for 16 years. because the West, guarantors of the peace agreement, the final and binding peace agreement between Ethiopia and Eritrea in 2000, refused to enforce the final and binding sanctions against Ethiopia. Why? Because Ethiopia is the policeman on the beat, the West gendarme in East Africa, and they've been enforcing Pax Americana's rule here for years. So Ethiopia is their strongman. They're the guys that invaded us. They're the ones that invaded Somalia. Ethiopia is 100% democracy with a parliament that's 100% government party members, okay? You know, and they're saying Ethiopia is a democracy and Eritrea is a dictatorship, when the reality is Ethiopia, when I'm speaking, is under martial law. Here, I can go out on the street night down and walk out on the streets openly and have a beer and a pizza or whatever I want. It's no problem. So I can travel freely around the country. There's not even border checkpoints anymore. I mean, control checkpoints for me. So
well,
I mean, it's like I have freedom of travel. I have freedom of association. I have freedom of speech here. All these things they claim. But you see, when we speak of human rights, we must be very clear about what, if you talk about in Africa, when you speak of human rights, what Africans want, if you ask them, first they tell you we have to have enough food to eat. Secondly, they say we have to have clean drinking water. Third, we have to have a roof over our head. Fourth, we have to have access to affordable medical care. And fifth, we want to have education for our children. This is what 99% of Africans will tell you the most important human rights we have to have.
And they have those things.
We don't have human rights.
So are you saying that they do have those?
Well, and especially in Eritrea. Especially here in Eritrea. I mean, you look at all our neighbors. There's a huge famine in Ethiopia. I had an article recently about how 300,000 Somali children are starving to death under the control of the United Nations. There's war and famine in Sudan. There's huge chaos in Yemen across from us. I mean, around us, we're surrounded by all this people starving to death, people not having drinking water, people not having any medical care, education for the kids. All that we have in Eritrea because we're a socialist country just like Cuba. So they say we're a major human rights violator because we don't have free speech, or we don't have elections, or we don't have freedom of the press. But the reality is, our people have enough to eat, they have clean drinking water, they've got access to medical care, they've got the government's working on housing for everybody. We've got universal education now, it's up over 90% for our kids, which was like 29% at independence 25 years ago. So all these human rights, the real fundamental human rights Africans care about, the government's providing. And because we're in a state of no war, no peace, where the government's just not in a situation where they can say, oh, we allow Americans to come here and set up a newspaper. They can't do that. We're not in a situation where we can allow bin Laden and some fundamental Islamic fanatics to come here and set up a mosque and start saying Christianity is the apostates, and we have to kill them. The government can't tolerate some of that stuff. You know, we're half Muslim, half Christian. If you come into this country and you're a fundamentalist Christian from the United States, which we had big problems with, Pat Robertson received hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States government under George Bush to come in here and try to set up these born-again churches that told people, oh, don't go do national service, don't follow the government, you know, don't respect the socialism we have here, and that Islam is the devil, and half our country is Muslims.
Yeah.
The government couldn't allow that, so they arrested these people and shut down their churches.
Yeah, so aid is a weapon for imperialism.
And, you know, and religion as a weapon. You know, because, you know, I tell you, the first cell of the Islamic Jihad that bin Laden set up way back in 1992 when he was kicked out of Saudi Arabia and ended up in Sudan, the very first cell of Al-Qaeda was called the Eritrean Islamic Jihad because Eritrea had become independent the previous year, and bin Laden said, hey, we're going to make an Islamic regime out of Eritrea. And Eritrean Islamic Jihad was the very first cell of Al-Qaeda. And so, in other words, from the very beginnings of Eritrea's independence, Eritrea was fighting terrorism. And yet we're accused of terrorism. And because bin Laden and these people tried to come in and set up religious centers here in Eritrea and the government shut them down, oh, we're violating freedom of religion. Well, Pat Robertson came here with funding from the National Endowment for Democracy and tried to set up born-again churches here, Pentecost churches, and, you know, to destabilize the country and to cause conflict between Muslims and Christians. Because they were going around saying, oh, Islam is the devil. The government couldn't allow that, arrested them, put them in prison. And I'm very glad they did it, because we have religious peace here. My neighbors are Muslim. When they have Eid, we go and eat. When it's Easter or Christmas, they come over here and eat. We all live together peacefully. We don't want any of these outsiders come in. We don't want Wahhabism coming from Saudi. We don't want these religious fanatics, born-again Christians from the United States coming and stirring up trouble.
Yeah.
Because that's how the government enforces this religious stability here. We don't have religious freedom.
people have that sense that in a democracy there should be an opportunity to overthrow the, or not necessarily overthrow, but to at least challenge those in power. And I think that a major hit on the Eritrean government is that this government, Isaias, seems to go...
Americans have democracy.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, like, what happened? I mean,
America, they got democracy, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess you could say... I mean, I'm just looking at in terms of, like...
We got Hillary, crooked Hillary versus the Trumpster, right? I mean, we got a racist on one hand and a total crook and a warmonger on the other, and that's what the people got to vote for? That's democracy? You know what I'm saying? I mean, if that's democracy, we don't want it.
Right.
You know, we've seen all these Western countries and their so-called democracy. It's all about buy, rig, and steal. It's the people with the money make the rules. They get to call the shots. And even Hillary saying one thing in public and privately she's made all the promises to the already to the banksters. So, I mean, that's called democracy. We don't want that. Why should we want that?
Fair enough. But I'm just wondering, like, I know that in your writing you've generally been very favorable to the government, but what about journalists who are critical? Because what I'm hearing is that those who are critical of the government, they just don't. I mean, like you say, there's no actual freedom of the press there, and at least it seems the United States, like notwithstanding the duopoly of power, it is still possible to be critical of the power structure of the United States.
Well, I mean, long as you're not a threat.
Uh huh. But
I'm old enough to remember when the Black Panthers were around. And they had freedom of the speech until the FBI came and gunned down over 200 of them. That was freedom of the press. They became a threat, they killed them. If you're not a threat, they let you talk and complain all you want. You become a threat, they very quickly come in and gun you down, thanks to J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew people that were murdered by the FBI. I mean, I was old enough, they'd come to where I was living and they'd spoken, and then I got meet and hang out with them, and then a couple months later, they were dead in Los Angeles. I mean, the FBI gunned them down. So if you're a threat, you find out very quickly what the democracy really means. Otherwise, sure, they let you bitch and moan all you want until you become a threat.
Okay, so you're...
I mean, I'm not saying that everything is perfect here in Eritrea. This is no utopia, okay? I've got my issues with the government myself. I mean, people say, oh, he's a puppet of the government, but I've never, ever been on Eritrean television for an interview. I've never been interviewed. 10 years I've been here. I've been interviewed in all these international news channels in my own hometown. You've never seen me interviewed on the TV. You never see me write an article for the newspapers that I wrote for them. You never hear me interviewed on the radio. This is in my own hometown, and I'm internationally known. So I have my own issues with the Ministry of Information here, and they're not particularly happy always when I write things because maybe I go a little, you know, maybe I'm too radical for the government line. Who knows? But the point is that they, you know, but still they tolerate me. I mean, the thing is, see, I reflect reality on the ground here. I don't try to gloss things over and say everything's fine, but. You know, when I go out to the countryside, out to the villages where 70% of the Eritreans live, I see these dramatic changes the governments have made in the 10 years that I've been here. I mean, I see Eritrea is the second per capita user of solar power in the world. All these very remote villages have got solar-powered wells pumping clean drinking water out, human right. They've got irrigation systems that the government's built for them so they can grow their food all year round, enough food, human right. Okay, they've got schools and medical clinics powered by solar. These are really remote villages where people have never dreamed of these things, and their lives have really changed. And I've seen this in my own eyes in 10 years. So, you know, I reflect that when I speak positively about what's coming on here because we're a socialist country, and the needs of the most needy come first. So living in Asmara, a lot of people bitch and moan, our internet's too slow, and there's electric cuts, and sometimes there's not all the water we want, and da-da-da-da-da, and, you know... We go out to the villages and their lives have really changed. And so I have to reflect that because that's reality. And, you know, as a result, I reflect reality. The Eritrean people and some 100,000 of them come in home and visit every year. Outside, I'm a legend. I'm a hero to them because I'm the one white guy that's telling the truth about the country. I don't pretend everything is fine. And damn, no, it's not.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we don't have problems with bureaucracy, just like in Cuba. The bureaucracy drives people crazy in Cuba, just like here in Eritrea. It drives us crazy sometimes. But that's just a growing pains in what's called socialism, the transition to a more equalitarian country. You know what I'm saying? And see, when you say democratic outside, I just look at all these bought and sold politicians that are just fronts for the banksters, and that's what we want here? I just know. It's got to be something better. Of course, we've got a threat of a war of Ethiopia hanging over our heads for the last 16 years. So how can you have all this openness in your society? Now, you mentioned journalists. Now, it's interesting because when I first came here in 2011, I actually met some of these so-called journalists, okay? And I actually walked the streets and saw copies of the newspaper they were publishing, okay? And I'm one of the only Western guys that actually met some of these guys that were thrown in prison. And lo and behold, they were hanging out at the U.S. Embassy. They were catching, they were collecting big chunks of wads of cash to come out and fund these newspapers that had no obvious means of support. I actually investigated these papers. They weren't self-sufficient. They weren't self-sustaining. Somebody was paying for them. And when I tried to raise these questions with these so-called journalists, they just ran away, literally. And it turns out most of them were part of a National Endowment for Democracy-funded program for journalism in Eritrea. In other words, the CIA came here and started up a bunch of so-called opposition newspapers for the point of destabilizing the country. And they got arrested. You know, some of them hadn't paid any income taxes for 6 or 7 years. Now, you're in Canada. If you have a business for 6 or 7 years and you never declare any taxes, the government's going to come in and lean on you, right? You're going to get thrown in jail, most likely. So that's what happened here. And on top of that, we established the fact that these guys are receiving funding and training as journalists, quote-unquote, from the National Endowment for Democracy. Okay, famous CIA front. So, hey, I actually met some of these guys. Nobody outside has met any of them. And get this, nobody can produce a single publication in Tigrinya that any of these people actually published in Eritrea to prove that they were journalists, let alone arrested for calling for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
They can't even produce. I repeatedly contacted all these press groups and everybody else and said, for the last 15 years and said, can you provide me with anything these guys actually published in Eritrea to prove they're journalists? And no one can. The best they came up with is, I've got a translation. If they haven't even got anything published, how can they even claim they're journalists? This is how shoddy the work is. I mean, they're not journalists. They're prostitutes for making all these claims.
Uh-huh.
They can't even produce anything these guys published. So I mean, I'm saying is, I've been around and around all these so-called human rights and I had an article in the Committee to Protect Journalists website where I identified myself as an independent journalist in Eritrea, and 6 months later, they published a report saying there were no independent journalists in Eritrea, and they had my identify myself in their own blog. I mean, these guys are really shoddy. They're lazy. They just spout propaganda and lies. They've never, ever been here, none of these people. Okay. Why don't they call me up and talk to me and ask me what's going on before they publish all this rubbish? Because they got an agenda.
Yeah, could
and
you
we trace it back and find out all kinds of nasty ties between them and the U.S. intelligence community. That's
yeah,
another story.
Sort of, yeah, I know, the whole colored revolution business. I'm wondering if you could just maybe give us a because we're running a little bit short on time now, but, you're talking about amassing of troops at the border and, this idea. I'm wondering if we're going to be seeing in the months to come, just as with Libya, there was, they started with all human rights, and then bombed the place. Yemen, which is on the other side of the Red Sea there, is under attack from Saudi Arabia. Are we perhaps seeing a duplication of the Saudi-Yemen conflict, but in this instance, Ethiopia being the instigator? How are things looking moving forward?
Well, see, Ethiopia is in the midst of the worst crisis in the last 25 years since the previous regime was overthrown. There's these massive demonstrations all across Ethiopia against the ethnic minority regime that the U.S. has been backing and monopolizing power, and it's one of the most brutal and corrupt regimes in the world, let alone Africa. And the people have been starving, people have been suffering in Ethiopia. They started peacefully protesting, and they were met with gunfire. Thousands of them have been gunned down. Don't believe the reports, 400 or 500. Thousands and thousands of Ethiopians have been gunned down. Probably 20 or 30, maybe 40,000 Ethiopians have been locked up in the last few weeks. There's martial law in the entire Ethiopia. Yesterday, the U.S. Embassy in Ethiopia complained because there is no internet. They shut off internet access in the whole of Ethiopia under this martial law regime. And Ethiopia is the linchpin, the U.S. control of the Horn of Africa. They've been the policemen, the major military force. Ethiopia is the largest recipient of military aid in Africa from the United States and the Western countries. So Ethiopia's been the strongman out here. Ethiopia just had to pull their troops out of Somalia to come back and stabilize to suppress the protests in Ethiopia, and Al-Shabaab's taken over big swaths of Somalia now. So Ethiopia has historically been the policeman on the beat out here, and they're in crisis. It's just a matter of time Ethiopia's going to go down. I had an article about, it's called Revolutionary Islam and the Regime Change in Ethiopia, how we may see a revolutionary Islamic government come to power in Ethiopia, like what happened in Iran. So, I mean, Ethiopia's in crisis right now. So the United States is sort of in a bad, really bad spot. On the one hand, they're worried about Eritrea because all the Ethiopian opposition leadership are based here. The exile movement's all based in Eritrea. And if there's going to be regime change in Ethiopia, that there's regime change that the Ethiopian people want, it's going to be led by the leadership of the Ethiopian resistance that's based here in Eritrea. So, and that's got the Americans worried because they don't want an independent nationalist government in power in Africa's second largest country, Ethiopia, in a very critical spot in the Horn of Africa. So the Americans are trying to look around right now pretty desperately for alternatives to the present regime, and they really don't have any. And so I expect a lot more American blaming Eritrea for supporting terrorism, or American saying Eritrea is interfering in Ethiopia. We're a small country, 4 or 5 million, they're 90 million, and yet we're going to interfere in them. Well, you know, that's just the reality that the Americans are always looking for somebody to blame besides their own corrupt, brutal dictators that they basically put in power and kept in power with all these billions and billions in foreign aid. But Ethiopia is coming to, you know, there's going to be a regime change. It's just a matter of time. This Ethiopian people are fed up. I mean, the whole country's under martial law. How are you going to keep 90 million people under martial law indefinitely? You see what I'm saying? It's a crime now. If you listen to Voice of America, if you're caught listening to Voice of America in Ethiopia, you can get up to 5 years in prison. Voice of America, 5 years in prison? I mean, how long are they going to, you know what I'm saying? Wait a second. The Americans support the Ethiopians and claim they're a democratic government, and yet for listening to American government propaganda, you can get 5 years in prison? Mm-hmm. I mean, things in Ethiopia are pretty desperate for the government. They're just hanging on. How much longer they're going to hold on, we don't know. But when they fall, this whole area is going to go up for grabs, and it's going to be very dangerous, not only for American imperialism, but also for peace-loving people like us, because, you know, it's going to be wide open for the Wahhabists to come in, and Al-Qaeda to get started, or ISIS to get started, and for who, God knows, you know, I mean, this just could be chaos. Plus that the CIA, like in South Sudan, which we have Ethiopia splits into small countries, we could be like South Sudan, where the CIA is going to come in and start a dirty war between ethnic groups to try to control the region. So, you know, there's a lot of dangers out here. But right now, Eritrea is not the place that's going to have the problem. The problem is going to be Ethiopia. We don't know what's going to happen in Ethiopia, and that's something I'm trying to get everybody to wake up to, because we're far away and we're pretty remote, but strategically, it's a really critical part of the world.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we just seem to live in this bubble, and Africa, we tend to not pay attention to it at all unless there's some major, you know, propaganda offensive that needs to be communicated in advance of the next military operation or hybrid war or what have you. Thomas C. Mountain, I'm afraid I have to go now, but I appreciate your sharing that insight and that alternative analysis of this whole situation and putting it in its proper geopolitical context. I appreciate it, and I'd like to wish you a good evening.
Well, I'd like to say a few words to your listeners out there. You know, there's
sure.
just a few programs like this, like your program. They've got to support these programs. They've got to pull some money out of their pocket and donate it when it comes time to give, because there's very few places where you can get the real truth about what's going on out here in Africa. And your program here that you're listening to right now is one of them. So please dig down deep and contribute, okay?
Thanks so much.
Thomas C. Mountain is an independent journalist based in Asmara, Eritrea since 2006. His articles appear at Counterpunch, Black Agenda Report, and other online news sites. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.